Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Happening now, troubling contradictions in the fatal police beating of Tyree Nichols. We're breaking down initial claims made by police officers and how they don't match up with videos of Nichols' arrest. Also tonight, CNN's exclusive one-on-one interview with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's revealing whether he'd consider acting as a wartime mediator between Ukraine and Russia. And we're getting our first look at former President Donald Trump's defiant deposition in a fraud investigation in New York. This, as he's facing a new criminal probe of hush money payments over his alleged affair with porn star Stormy Daniels. Welcome to our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room. We begin this hour with the glaring discrepancies between the initial Memphis police report on Tyree Nichols' case and the videos of his arrest and beating. CNN's Nick Valencia is covering all the new developments.
Hey, he took our running soon. I seen a white.
A bundle of contradictions between what the world witnessed in the video showing police beating Tyree Nichols and what's reportedly found in the initial police report about the incident. First reported by the New York Times, a photo of a police report was posted online by a Memphis talk show host. The district attorney's office tells CNN the DA does have a report that has that same account of events. The report suggests Nichols was pulled over after police say he veered into oncoming traffic. It says he was violent, sweating profusely and irate when he exited the vehicle, and, quote, started to fight with officers, at one point grabbing one of the detectives' gun. Things not seen in the body camera and Sky Cop street camera videos, but the very things officers talked about during the encounter.
High as a kite.
Mm-hmm.
I hit that man with so many pieces, and
then he's
come
over.
The report also says Nichols was struck with a department-issued baton while given verbal commands to stop resisting. It notes nothing about the multiple times officers kicked him while he was lying on the ground. The Memphis Police Department still hasn't officially released the report all these weeks later. The Shelby County Sheriff's Office, also listed in that report image posted online, releasing a statement saying the release of reports in connection with the investigation is unauthorized and the Sheriff's Office cannot comment.
This issue of believing police reports on their face as they're immediately released is something we also need to reconsider.
Officials announced more firings and disciplinary actions against public servants at the scene. In addition to the firings of the five black Memphis police officers now facing second-degree murder charges, three Memphis Fire Department personnel have been let go, and two sheriff's deputies have been put on leave, along with the two additional Memphis Police Department officers also on leave.
We are looking at everybody who had any kind of involvement in this incident.
Everybody who was on that scene who contributed in any way should be held fully accountable.
As Tyree Nichols' family prepares to say their final goodbyes tomorrow.
My brother was an innocent person. Everybody knows that my brother was filled with energy. He was like the light of the room.
And tonight we're learning that the vice president will be in attendance at Tyree Nichols' funeral on Wednesday. She will be joining other senior level officials from the Biden administration. And meanwhile, the family tells us, Wolf, that the vice president called them earlier today to offer her condolences and support during this unimaginably difficult time. Wolf.
All right, Nick. Thanks very much. Nick Valencia reporting. Let's bring in our experts on law enforcement, legal affairs and civil rights right now. And John Miller, I'll start with you. What do you make of the discrepancies in this police report?
Well, the discrepancies, Wolf, are with what was written and what actually happened. You see them being built when you see at the end of the incident, when the officers are talking to each other, they're building that story. One of them says, did you see how he came out of the car and he went right for me? The tape doesn't show that. He says, another officer says, you know, he went for my gun. If that happened, the tape doesn't show that. So it seems they were building that narrative before the report was written. Notably, the report is written by an officer who, in the writing of the report, puts himself on the scene, who is not one of those criminally charged, and maybe that other officer who was relieved of duty because the report seems to have real gaps when it comes to fact.
Chief Ramsey, what do you think of these, what strikes you about these clearly glaring discrepancies?
Well, they weren't being truthful. I mean, that's pretty obvious. When you look at the video and then you compare it to the report, it just doesn't match. And so whoever wrote that report, they would have signed it. They would have put their badge number on it. So that's not a secret. Certainly the DA and the department knows exactly who wrote the report. And I agree with John. I mean, when you hear them describing what took place in their own words, again, it's not consistent with what we've seen in the video. So that's something else that certainly the DA is going to be considering. And from an administrative standpoint, for officers, especially the one that wrote that report, if it doesn't rise to the level of any kind of criminal charge, certainly they'll face some kind of internal discipline.
Arriva, from a legal perspective, how could these discrepancies actually factor into the cases against these fired police officers? They're facing major criminal charges.
Well, what the issue is, who gave this officer this information? And did this officer intentionally lie on this police report? One thing that's so troubling about this whole investigation at this point, Wolf, is the drip, 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 drip nature of it. We have the police chief who takes this very, what's being called swift action in terms of firing these officers, putting these others on administrative leave. But yet we have not seen this police chief come out and answer questions. Questions about these two officers who are on administrative leave. Has many people in the black community asking, was the white officer who we're now learning about, is he being treated differently? Is he being shielded in a way that these black officers are not? And what happened with this police report? They say it's an official document, can't be released, but surely the chief can come forward, stand up before news reporters and answer questions about what was in that police report and what they know about the discrepancies in the report. So there's still so many unanswered questions, and it causes us to believe that this department is not being as transparent as they would have had us to believe in the beginning once they started revealing information about this case.
Derek Johnson is with us as well. He's the president and CEO of the NAACP. I know you have joined with other prominent civil rights leaders, Derek, to request an actual meeting with President Biden to discuss the issue of police brutality. Have you gotten any response from the White House about that request? And what would you like to convey to the president?
We expect to get a response before the end of the week. But we're going to convey what we've consistently conveyed. This is an issue that needs to be addressed through public policy. Obviously, there is a culture of this behavior, not only with the Memphis Police Department, but there's no accountability for falsifying documents. There is nothing to put any threat behind law enforcement officers for simply writing up a report. We've seen it in the George Floyd case. We've seen it in the Tamir Rice case. We see it all across the country. But this department appears to have a pattern and practice. No one sought to assist when you seen the victim there suffering. The fire department didn't assist. Other officers who came on the scene didn't assist. They allowed this young man to languish for over 20 plus minutes before getting them to the hospitals. We must have federal public policy to address this issue.
Chief Ramsey, so far charges have only been brought against five fired police officers, but we're learning about others on the scene who are now being relieved of duty. Are you concerned at all about the lack of transparency here?
No, listen, I understand the process. They prioritized what they needed to do. You had five individuals that were obviously directly involved in the injuries and the subsequent death of Mr. Nichols. And they did that as quickly as they could. I've had cases where you've had multiple police officers on the scene and reviewing video. When you look at the video, you have to isolate each individual officer and follow their movements from beginning to end to know exactly what they did. Now, I had a case that involved about a dozen officers. It took quite a while before we were able to do it, but we had to sort out those that were directly involved, and then also those that just failed to take action. So it's either the action or inaction of the officers that have to be reviewed. You've got two more that have been at least placed on administrative leave, and there may be more. Now, whether or not they're charged criminally is a different matter that the DA would have to take part in. But as far as, you know, the drip, if you want to call it that, I really am not concerned about it. I don't think it's a drip. I think it's just the process and how it plays out.
All right, guys. Thanks to all of you. Thanks very, very much. Just ahead, CNN's exclusive interview with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu amid a flare-up of tensions in the region. How he responded when asked if he would consider acting as a wartime mediator between Ukraine and Russia. Stay with us. You're in the Situation Room. Tonight, a CNN exclusive with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He sat down for a lengthy one-on-one interview with my colleague Jake Tapper amid high tensions and a new outbreak of violence in the Middle East. Jake is joining us now live from Jerusalem. Jake, this is truly a pivotal moment for Netanyahu, indeed for Israel and the Palestinians. Give us your top takeaways from your exclusive interview.
Well, Wolf, we talked about so much, including spiraling violence going on right here between the Israelis and Palestinians, what he thought about a potential two-state solution, which Secretary of State Blinken was discussing earlier. One of the things that struck me was the fact that he did seem amenable to negotiations when it comes to his controversial proposal to reform the judiciary to, in the views of many critics, undermine the judiciary so that the Israeli parliament, with a simple majority vote, could overrule the Israeli Supreme Court. He seemed open to negotiations on that. But it was such a far-ranging interview, it's tough for me to pick out one specific item.
I understand you also discussed the war in Ukraine and Netanyahu's potential role as a possible mediator. Tell us what he said.
Yeah, you know, it's been interesting because Netanyahu has not agreed to help Ukraine militarily, at least not openly so. So we discussed that at length, especially considering the fact that Iran is now with Russia in attacking Ukraine. So there has been talk about maybe Netanyahu would be somebody that could broker a peace between Zelensky and Putin. I asked him about it. Take a listen.
One thing I wanted to ask you about Russia and Ukraine is that an advisor to Zelensky floated your name as somebody who might be a decent mediator between Zelensky and Putin, between Ukraine and Russia. And I'm wondering if anyone in any position of power has ever floated that idea to you, and what would be your willingness to take on that job?
I was asked to do that early on in the breakout of the Ukraine war. And I was opposition leader at the time, and I said, well, I have a rule, one prime minister at the time, you know, like one president at the time.
Who asked you to do it?
I was asked. Okay. I don't know if it was official, but it was unofficial, so I didn't even pursue it. I said, there's a prime minister, let him, you know, decide what to do with that. He tried, didn't succeed. But if...
Would you do it now?
If I'm asked by both sides... And frankly, if I'm asked by the United States, because I think, you know, you can't have too many cooks in the kitchen, you know, and I'm, you know, we have our own backyard to deal with.
Right.
It's not that I think this is of monumental importance, because I think the peace of the world is at stake. As I think the peace of the world is at stake with Iran getting nuclear weapons, it'll destabilize the entire world. And so, you know, I'm really devoting my efforts to that and the other peace ideas that I have, and the economic ideas. But if asked by all relevant parties, I'll certainly consider it. But I'm not pushing myself in, I've been around long enough to know that there has to be a ripe time and the ripe circumstances. If they arise, I'll certainly consider it.
And as you heard there, Wolf, obviously, Prime Minister, rather, Benjamin Netanyahu certainly has Iran on top of mind, as well as the current Israeli-Palestinian conflict. We also talked a great deal about his controversial right-wing government allies cabinet officials who cabinet ministers who have said some and done some incredibly offensive and controversial things in the past. And then, of course, we talked a little bit about American politics as well. It's all coming up at 9 p.m.
Thanks so much, Jake. Thanks for going over there. Thanks for doing the interview. Jake's full interview with Prime Minister Netanyahu airs during a special report tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. And I'll be back at 10 p.m. Eastern later tonight with analysis of that interview and the situation in the Middle East right now. It's a very tense situation. Right now, let's get some more from the war zone in Ukraine, where officials say Russian forces are turning the key eastern city of Bakhmut into what I'm quoting now, a total ruin. Our senior international correspondent, Sam Kiley, is joining us live from Kyiv right now. He's got an update. Sam, is the battle for Bakhmut reaching a critical point?
It probably is, Wolf. I've spoken to people who are fighting on the ground who think that, perhaps the Ukrainians, if things don't change, can hold on for another week or two, perhaps. But the things are changing rapidly on the ground. What's been going on, Wolf, is that for many months now, the Wagner Group especially has been sending human waves of conscripts or prisoners, alleged volunteers, to the Russian mercenary company, with very light arms, charging Ukrainian positions, dying in large numbers, and then there's a follow-up from artillery. But that artillery, aircraft, multiple rocket launching systems have all been pounding the town of Bakhmut until there's almost nothing left and very, very few civilians still cowering in the underground bunkers. Meanwhile, of course, there's also been Russian attacks to the south and north with the capture of Solidar. And at some stage, it's likely, perhaps, that the Ukrainians may elect to withdraw in order to save their soldiers' lives, especially as they don't attach a great deal of strategic importance to the town of Bakhmut in the first place, Wolf.
And Sam, as this fighting clearly intensifies in the eastern part of Ukraine, what's the latest on Western weapons support for Ukraine?
Well, you'll recall that a few days ago, the Ukrainian ambassador to France said that he thought that there was about 350 battle tanks had been pledged by NATO and other Western allies to Ukraine. We've now got a little bit more clarity on when those might arrive. The first tranche of 120 to 140 may be arriving quite soon. But the United Kingdom and the United States, for now at least, have ruled out the supply of any fighter jets and fighter bombers, which the Ukrainians have been calling for. The French are still saying nothing is off the table. A lot of this is to do with the ability to supply, not so much from the perspective of the United States, but the United Kingdom just doesn't have any aircraft to spare. The French potentially do because they've got some older Mirage aircraft that they could possibly allow Ukraine to get their hands on. And of course, elsewhere in Europe, there are also Soviet-era MiG fighter bombers that could be made available. But these are strategic weapons like the long-range rockets that they've also been repeatedly asking for. And at the moment, there is resistance to supply them with those strategic weapons for fear of escalation, particularly if they're used against targets inside Russia, Wolf.
CNN's Sam Kiley on the scene for us in Ukraine. As I say to you every day, stay safe over there, Sam. Thank you very, very much. Coming up, we're getting new video of former President Trump's deposition under oath in the New York probe into his business practices. Stay with us. You're in the Situation Room. Tonight, we're getting a rare look at former President Donald Trump testifying under oath. New video released today shows Trump repeatedly invoking the Fifth Amendment in the New York civil probe of his business. CNN's Brian Todd is joining us. He's been reporting on this story. So, Brian, what else can you tell us about this deposition?
Well, Wolf, probably on the advice of his lawyers, Donald Trump was about as careful as he could be in this proceeding, but he still took the opportunity to take a political shot at New York's attorney general.
I do.
In the video, Donald Trump is defiant from the start.
I don't know what I did wrong, but the answer is yes.
This newly released video is from August 10th of last year, a deposition as part of a civil investigation into the Trump Organization's business practices, conducted by New York State Attorney General Letitia James. After this video deposition was taken, James filed a lawsuit against the former president, some of his children, and some executives of his business.
Mr. Trump, I understand you have a statement that you wanted to read into the record.
Yes.
At the beginning of this proceeding, Trump was allowed to give a statement.
This is the greatest witch hunt in the history of our country.
With James in the room, Trump called her investigation a disgrace to the legal system and accused her of going after him for her own political gain.
She developed a political platform and made a career out of maliciously attacking me and my business before she even understood or was elected.
Then Trump declared he wouldn't be answering any more questions.
Anyone in my position not taking the Fifth Amendment would be a fool.
But in the past, Trump has repeatedly ridiculed people who take the Fifth.
The mob takes the Fifth. If you're innocent, why are you taking the Fifth Amendment?
Same answer.
One legal analyst says Trump's appearance in this video could hurt him in this lawsuit, which is ongoing.
In this civil setting, unlike a criminal trial, they're able to take the fact of his taking the Fifth Amendment and ask the jury to hold it against him. That's big stuff.
The legal vice around the former president tightening in another case as well. Sources familiar with the matter tell CNN the Manhattan District Attorney's Office this week has begun presenting evidence to a grand jury about Trump's alleged role in paying hush money to porn star Stormy Daniels to keep quiet about an alleged affair he had with her several years ago. David Pecker, former head of the company that publishes the National Enquirer, was expected to meet with prosecutors in that case this week, sources tell CNN. Pecker was in the middle of what the former president's former lawyer Michael Cohen says was a 2016 scheme to pay Daniels $130,000 to stop her from going public about that alleged affair. Cohen providing an alleged reimbursement from Trump.
This is the case that Donald Trump thought he had put behind him several years ago. He thought he had escaped prosecution, and now investigators are looking at him anew. They're deciding whether or not to charge him with something that could upend his political journey.
Donald Trump has denied involvement in any payments made to Stormy Daniels and has in fact denied ever having an affair with her. A spokesperson for the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, declined to comment on the new acceleration of the Stormy Daniels case, and an attorney for David Pecker also would not comment. Wolf?
Brian Todd reporting for us. Thank you very much. Let's discuss all of this. Joining us now, CNN's Kara Scannell, our legal analyst Elliot Williams, and defense attorney Shan Wu. Kara, you've been doing a lot of reporting on the former president's legal battles, and there are so many. Tell us what you're learning now.
Well, Wolf, so right, what we see from this video today is 38 minutes of what was a more than four-hour interview, this deposition that Trump gave to the New York Attorney General's office. And he repeatedly invoked the Fifth Amendment more than 400 times. And as Brian laid out nicely in his piece, you know, he does set up the reasons why, but this could have legal ramifications for him. You know, it could be held against him as this civil lawsuit moves forward. And as of now, the judge overseeing this lawsuit has set a trial in this case for later this year. Wolf.
You know, important, Elliot, this video of Trump's deposition, as we know, is a reminder of the many investigations, legal investigations, he's under right now. What do you see as the most serious?
Well, they're all incredibly serious, Wolf. Look, I mean, I think we lose sight of the fact that anytime someone is investigated by state or federal authorities or sued in a, you know, $250 million lawsuit is one of them, you know, we lose sight of the fact when talking about all of them together, but they're all quite serious. Look, it appears based on reporting that had come out over the course of the last couple of weeks that the Fulton County, Georgia District Attorney's investigation is probably pretty far along, and it appears that charges are coming there, but they're all incredibly serious. These are real allegations of frivolous lawsuits and misconduct on the courts that should be taken really seriously.
You know, I want to turn, Shan, while I have you, to the Manhattan District Attorney now, who is presenting evidence to a grand jury on the hush money case, as it's called. What do you think led to this dramatic escalation? It's pretty dramatic.
Well, everyone thought that case was almost dead in the water. And from reporting, it sounds like maybe under Trump, DOJ helped to kill that case. But Bragg's feeling kind of confident. He's just won a couple of convictions against the Trump organization and the CFO. So that may be why it's resurfacing right now. I mean, Stormy Daniels may turn out to be the equivalent of taxes for Al Capone, for Trump. And this forgotten case, it's relatively easy to prove. I mean, people may not even remember it anymore. It's a campaign finance issue with the hush money. And under New York state law, if there's a falsification of business records, that's a misdemeanor, and they need to tie it to New York state election law violations to get the felony out of it. But not a very difficult case, so could go someplace.
Well, let me get Elliot to weigh in on this. Is this potentially a bigger legal threat to Trump right now than the Fulton County, Georgia grand jury investigation?
Now, what I'll note about the Fulton County, Georgia grand jury investigation is that a few of the things that are being investigated there are just straight campaign finance and campaign laws and being violated there. Like, as Shan was noting, there's a little bit of complexity here, sort of where you have to make a few steps to get there. What prosecutors often think of is, well, what are the elements of the offense and how easily can I prove each one of them? And a few of the, you know, for setting aside that she was talking about RICO charges, in Georgia, a few of the campaign law violations alleged in Georgia are pretty straightforward, and they may be sort of, there may be a cleaner path to convicting someone.
Yeah, all these legal battles for Trump are very, very serious. Kara, I know you also have some new reporting about a request the New York Attorney General is now making. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, if that's right, the New York Attorney General's office has asked a judge overseeing this $250 million fraud lawsuit, asking them to hold the former president, his three eldest children, and their attorneys, to charge them with sanctions. And the reason is that the New York Attorney General's office is saying that they have not responded truthfully to this lawsuit. They're required in a legal document to respond. They're saying, you know, that Trump, some of these statements are demonstrably false, that they contradict previous sworn testimony, and that they're using legal arguments that this judge has already ruled against. Now, this judge, Judge Arthur Engoron, he's a New York State judge, he has previously considered on his own sanctioning the Trump attorneys for repeating some legal arguments he's ruled on. Now, the New York Attorney General's office is asking him to take a second look at this and to hold a hearing in the near future.
Well, let me get Shan. What do you think the likely outcome of this is going to be? This one is going to be.
They may get sanctioned. And it's worth noting, it's so unusual. In Trump world, there are so many sanctions against attorneys, issues about frivolous lawsuits. In a simple discovery matter like this, it's rare to have a motion for sanctions just for people admitting some things and denying others. It's got to be pretty blatant for the New York State AG to be bringing this and for the court to consider it. And that just seems to be par for course in the world of Trump lawyering.
Yeah, this legal battle is not going away by any means. Guys, thank you very, very much. Just ahead, a newly revealed FBI search at the first site where classified documents related to President Biden were found, and why it's just coming to light now. Plus, George Santos now stepping away from some congressional responsibilities as he faces an investigation into his many lies. Tonight, we're learning more about the federal investigation of President Biden's handling of classified documents. Sources now revealing an FBI search that had not been disclosed by the White House or the president's legal team. CNN's chief White House correspondent Phil Mattingly is working the story for us. Phil, tell us about this search and why we're just learning about it now when it actually happened back in November.
Yeah, well, the timeline of the acknowledgement of this search certainly raises more questions than what has been a kind of persistent drip of information over the course of the last several weeks. But to some degree, the explanation, according to both justice officials and in past White House statements, is that this was part of the FBI assessment that transpired after the initial classified documents were found at the Penn Biden Center, the Biden-affiliated think tank, in early November. Now, that assessment was cited by Attorney General Merrick Garland when he announced the full timeline that included the appointment of the special counsel in January. Now, part of this search was essentially to get a sense of the actual location itself. In fact, Wolf, the documents had already been transferred over to the National Archives when the FBI searched the Penn Biden Center. And that search was conducted in coordination and cooperation with Biden attorneys. And what this was all part of was basically the process in the months that led up to the appointment of the special counsel, that review that was put underway once it became clear that classified documents had been discovered. Now, White House officials in their public statements related to this process throughout said that their lawyers had been cooperating throughout the process, made clear that when the president's home in Wilmington was searched and classified documents were found, that the process of setting up that search by FBI agents was very similar to what they had conducted with the Penn Biden Center as well. But they never explicitly said there had been an FBI search of the Penn Biden Center. That is now clear that that happened. It happened in mid-November. member as part of that assessment process. What this all leads to right now, Wolf, is the process that we didn't get any window into throughout several months is becoming more clear by the day. What isn't becoming more clear at this point in time is where the special counsel investigation is going to lead. We do know that the special counsel, Robert Hur, is slated to start his process this week, taking over this portfolio. But how long that investigation will go and where it will lead, still an open question. White House officials, though, contend they don't believe they did anything wrong, and they say when this investigation is complete, it will show that their lawyers did the right things in the right timeline, Wolf.
All right, Phil, thank you very much. Phil Mattingly over at the White House. Tonight, President Biden is preparing for his very high-stakes meeting with the House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Their showdown over the debt limit getting testy just hours before their talks tomorrow. Let's bring in our Capitol Hill reporter Melanie Zanona and CNN senior political analyst Nia Malika Henderson. Melanie, first to you, Biden and McCarthy have been trading barbs just ahead of these critically important talks. What's the latest you're learning?
Yeah, well, there has been so much political posturing ahead of this meeting tomorrow. Earlier today, Speaker McCarthy said that President Biden was irresponsible for refusing to negotiate whatsoever on the debt ceiling. Then a little bit later, Biden responded by criticizing McCarthy at a private fundraiser, saying that McCarthy had to make all these off-the-wall deals to become Speaker. And then moments ago, McCarthy responded to that, to one of our colleagues, saying that President Biden just doesn't get it. So that back and forth is a pretty strong indication that tomorrow's meeting is not going to be very productive or fruitful, but it is an important first step in what is going to be a very lengthy process. And both men are walking into the meeting tomorrow with very different goals in mind. For Biden, he wants to show that Republicans aren't unified just yet over a single plan to cut spending. And for McCarthy, he wants Biden to at least acknowledge that they are going to have to find some common ground with Republicans to resolve this issue. So still a long road ahead and still very, very far apart between the two sides.
The economic stakes are clearly, clearly enormous. Melanie, you're there up on Capitol Hill. Let me follow up. This comes as New York Republican Congressman George Santos says he's stepping down from his House committees, at least for now. What prompted this move?
Well, there had been growing pressure on George Santos to resign. He is refusing to do that. But I suspect him deciding to remove himself from some of these committee assignments is a way to take some of the heat off of him. And Santos also told reporters earlier today that he made this decision on his own accord. Take a listen.
Did McCarthy tell you to step away from the committees, or did you make this decision?
Nobody tells me to do anything. I made a decision on my own that I thought best represented the interests of the bill.
Now, Santos did say that he intends to serve on committees once he is able to clear his name, but it remains to be seen whether that is ever going to happen. He is under federal investigation for his finances. He is also likely to face a House ethics probe.
He's got a lot going on. Nia, you just heard Santos say he made the decision that he thought best represented the voters in his district. But according to a new Newsday Siena College poll, 78% of the voters in his district say he should resign. How can he square that?
And listen, 71% of Republican voters want him to resign. These are people who voted for him and now have no faith in him at this point. He clearly wanted to step down to take some of the heat off of himself and take some of the heat off of his party. Democrats, I think, have been pretty expert at, in some ways, making him the face of the party. And as there are these discussions about who should be on committees, it's really inconvenient, I think, for McCarthy to have him on this committee. But he's certainly not following the will of the voters at this point, because the vast majority of voters who voted to put him in Congress want him to step down. And it remains to be seen whether or not this is sort of an interim step. What else is going to happen? Obviously, these investigations are going on as well.
And Nia, as you know, Congressman Santos, he actually gave an interview today to the right-wing One America News Network, and he insists things will be different going forward. Listen to this.
And I've learned my lesson, and you can guarantee, I can guarantee you that from now on, anything and everything is always going to be above board. It's largely always been above board. I'm just going to go the extra step now to double check, cross-reference everything.
What's your reaction to that, Nia?
Well, you know, he's lying in that instance, right? I mean, things haven't largely been above board. He created a whole entire resume that was not true. He made up a Jewish identity. He said that his mother had died of 9/11 related causes. That turned out to be a lie. He lied about his education. He lied about playing volleyball in college. All sorts of random lies that he's been telling about himself over these last years. We'll see if anything else comes out at this point. In that interview, he was kind of defiant. I mean, he talked about Biden. He said that Biden was a pathological liar, trying to defend himself there. So it was a very bizarre interview. Somewhat sympathetic, I think, the interview was to him. But he sort of pushed back and said, you know, he won't do it again. And he's sorry about what happened before. We'll see what the voters decide. Listen, Congress could actually expel him. It would have to go through an ethics committee, and they would need two-thirds of folks in Congress to actually expel him. In the House, that probably won't happen because McCarthy needs that vote because his margins are so slim.
Yeah, you're right. Nia Malika Henderson, Melanie Zanona. Ladies, thank you very, very much. Coming up, official charges just filed against Alec Baldwin for the fatal Rust movie set shooting. We'll have details on where the case against him and the film's armorer goes from here. Stay with us. In New Mexico, prosecutors have just formally filed charges in the deadly 2021 shooting on the set of the movie Rust. Alec Baldwin, as well as the film's armorer, both facing two counts of involuntary manslaughter. CNN's Chloe Malas is joining us now with more. Chloe, so what are the prosecutors alleging?
So the official charges were filed this afternoon, Wolf. And in these charging documents, we get a sense of what led to the district attorney's decision to give, you know, Alec Baldwin these two counts, charges of manslaughter. Same with Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, who was the armorer on the set of Rust in 2021. We have not heard from Alec Baldwin's team and Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, you know, denying that she did anything wrong. I just want to read to you some of the allegations against Alec Baldwin in these charging documents. So the district attorney says that Alec Baldwin did not take part in the necessary firearms training, that he only did about 30 minutes of a 90-minute session, and that he was on the phone with his family, not paying attention, that safety protocols and checks were skipped, that Hannah Gutierrez-Reed failed to inspect the gun when she was supposed to. Now, she maintains that she should have been called back into the church for this rehearsal filming, and that she never was, and that she could have prevented this death of Helena Hutchins, the cinematographer, had she been called back in. And then they also claim that there was no gun malfunction. Now, Alec Baldwin has always claimed that he did not pull the trigger and that the gun went off. He said that to me over the summer when I sat down with him, Wolf. But the district attorney is saying, no, we don't believe that. We believe that he pulled the trigger. We've seen videos and photos from behind the scenes that clearly show his finger on the trigger at different points, and that the FBI never found that the gun malfunctioned. They also claim that they found five more live rounds on the set. And remember, there was never supposed to be live ammunition on the set, Wolf. How did those live rounds get to set? We may never know. It's not explained here. And the district attorney said to our CNN Josh Campbell the other week that we may never know, and that many safety complaints were not addressed. They say in the charging documents that if Baldwin had not pointed the gun at Hutchins, that this tragedy would not have occurred, and that he should have always assumed that the gun was a loaded gun, and that Alec Baldwin had worked on over 40 movies with guns. But again, we've reached out to Baldwin. We haven't heard anything back. But as of now, he is still expected this spring, Wolf, to go back and finish the movie of Rust. And that is still to be seen. But a lot is at play here. This could go to trial.
Shall see. Chloe Malas, thank you very, very much. Just ahead, a very dangerous and deadly ice storm in Texas is causing cars to slide out of control and crash on major highways. The triple threat of ice, sleet, and snow hitting millions in the South. That's next. We're following a dangerous winter storm pummeling the central and southern United States. Our senior national correspondent, Ed Lemondere, is joining us right now from hard-hit Dallas. How bad is it there right now, Ed?
Well, you know, the roadways all across North Texas and down into Central Texas as well, just a complete mess. This is a Central Expressway, which cuts through the heart of the Dallas area. And you can see just how light the traffic has been. And it's been like this throughout the day. Millions of people staying home from work and from school today because of this winter warning and this winter storm, which brought in a heavy amount of sleet and freezing rain earlier today. And more is expected tomorrow. And it has really blanketed the roadways and made moving around in the area very treacherous. You can see that is the highways, intersections like this are really kind of hardened up with this sleet that has fallen here. And that in the overnight hours is expected to continue to harden up, which will make driving even more treacherous tomorrow. All of that coming as forecasters are predicting more freezing rain and sleet to continue falling on the area. So it is something that this the people who live here in North Texas and into Oklahoma and Arkansas are going to have to brace for more of this winter weather in the day ahead. In fact, forecasters, Wolf, are saying that the worst of this really might not be over until Thursday morning before we get a clearing from the intense cold temperatures that is freezing everything here on the ground and making moving around and driving around so treacherous. Wolf?
Treacherous indeed. Ed Lemondera, thank you very much. And to our viewers, thanks for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. I'll see you later again, later tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern. Aaron Burnett Out Front starts right now.
When you work, you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.